All right, so let's go ahead and get started.
Things going okay? Any concerns, worries about the exam that you want to bring up? Questions?
I'm worried about the exam.
Good. Okay, so last time we started talking a bit about Fourier analysis, and just to give you a sense of what we're going to do, I don't think Jane Coley does much for Fourier analysis, so this is where we're going to go a little bit beyond what Jane Coley does. I'm doing it for a number of reasons, one of which is it's time. You're at the stage where you need to be getting this stuff. I do believe many of you may be seeing it in other, beginning to see it in other classes, so it may mesh with that. It's an extremely useful mathematical thing, and as you begin to work your way up into more advanced classes, you're going to see this stuff used quite a bit. So I'm going to introduce Fourier analysis, and I'll draw a line. I'm going to take you to a certain point in it, and it's up to that point I'll expect you to be able to do it, and I'll give you some problems and expect you to figure that out. And then I'm going to push it a good bit further, but I'm not going to have expectations that you perform anything from that on the test, but you'll want to have seen it, and conceptually it will take us to a point in our understanding of waves that will make some really fundamental aspects of quantum mechanics make sense, all sorts of mystery out of some pieces of quantum mechanics that are quite critical. So I do think it's generally worth our time. So we started last time talking about Fourier analysis, and the basic idea of Fourier analysis is if I have some periodic function, we'll say it has spatial period lambda, function of x, I can describe it in terms of an infinite series of harmonic functions with successively higher frequencies or integral submultiples of wavelength, if you want to think of it that way. So you have a constant term, a term in, you know, cosines and sines are basically orthogonal to one another, so you have to have one of each if you really want to represent things that are odd and even functions. Then you have an infinite sum over successively smaller wavelengths, right? K is 2 pi over lambda. So if I have an integral m here, it's effectively giving you a cosine function with a periodicity that has lambda successively shorter by integral multiples. So you're building this thing of an infinite series of harmonic pieces with successive higher frequencies basically added together, and each of which is free to have a different amplitude. Okay? And by basically juggling these, you're effectively also able to change the phase of these things as you add them together. So the whole idea then is to, if you have some functions, to figure out what these various constants are. And if you know that, then you have succeeded in being able to describe it in its terms. And, you know, it may be that when you first see it, you might think, why do I care? That will sort of become obvious. So I'm not going to worry too much about belaboring that at this point. At any rate, so last time we talked a bit about how one goes about finding these constants. So if you look up at the term, at the fundamental equation from Fourier's theorem, I can integrate both sides from 0 to lambda, so over one period of x. And when I do that, all of the harmonic terms will go to 0. And I'm left with just this term and that term. So basically, a0 over 2 is just a constant, so I integrate dx over lambda. I basically just get a lambda. And so we can determine a0 as 2 over lambda times that integral. So depending on what the function is, you have to be able to do that integral if you want to determine what a0 is. To find the a's, the other constants, the constants in from the cosines and sines. We use the orthogonality of the sine and cosine functions, which basically says if I integrate over a period the sine times the cosine, I'll get zero. And if I integrate sine times sine, where these are allowed to have different submultiple, different wavelengths, the a's and b's will be integers, but they can be different integers. Or cosine, cosine, what we find, in fact, is that it is always zero unless a is equal to b, and you have a sine squared or a cosine squared, in which case it's lambda over 2. And we signify this sort of reality step function of 0 or 1, depending on whether these things are equal or not, by this symbol which we call a Kronecker delta. So you'll see it a lot. And there's nothing magic about it. It's just 1 when A is equal to B and 0 when A is not equal to B. So to find the A sub, I say A sub L, so to find some integer, some A sub, one of the A sub M components, let's pick the L one, for example, then I multiply both sides of this initial equation by cosine LKX, and I integrate it from 0 to lambda. So when I do that on the left-hand side, I multiply by the cosine LKX, I integrate from 0 to lambda, and there's something. Okay, I have to know what f of x is before I can do anything with that. On the right-hand side, I multiply by the cosine term, and I integrate from 0 to lambda, but when I integrate this over a full wavelength, it's 0, like any harmonic function is. For this term, all the sines get multiplied by these cosines, and when I integrate that over a period, it's always 0 because of the orthogonality of sines and cosines. For the other term, though, the one that multiplies the a's and m's, I end up with a cosine squared. If m is not equal to l, then the Kronecker delta tells me that this is 0. So this integral becomes 0 for m not equal to l, and it is only for m equal to l that this is non-zero, and it's equal to lambda over 2 for that. Okay, so expand it out doing this, I get this on the left-hand side, and then this term on the right-hand side where I've said that l is equal, that m is equal to l, because that's the only one that's non-zero, and this integral is lambda over 2. Okay? So when I do that, I can then solve for a sub l, and it's equal to 2 over lambda times this integral, whatever that integral is, and you have to know what f of x is to do it. Okay?
So you can imagine I can do exactly the same thing, except instead of multiplying by cosine LKX, I multiply by sine LKX, and it will project out the B sub L coefficient, the coefficient of the L term of this infinite series. And everything else is zero, except for on the left-hand side. So when I do that in complete analogous fashion to what we have here, we have b sub l is 0 lambda times the integral from 0 lambda of f of x times the sine function. Okay? Again, if you know f of x, you can do that function. So see, Fourier analysis is easy. We're all done. Okay. So I want to do an example for you.
Let us suppose that we have a function which I graph here. It is infinite in length both directions. It is periodic with period t. So that this is really what I mean by definition, periodic with period t. And then I say that it is plus 1 for all intervals which are at the front end of the period. So between 0 and period over 2, it's plus 1. And between period over 2 to period, it's minus 1. And at the boundaries, it's zero. And this function just repeats both directions. Okay? So the problem is, find a solution for f of t using Fourier analysis. So we start out by looking at using Fourier's theorem and writing the general solution. In this case, we're working on a variable t rather than position, where we're looking at time. So we want to write it as a function of t. We again have a constant. Here the cosines are, everything is of the same form except instead of k, because I'm doing periods in time instead of periods in wavelength. I use a 2 pi over the period here, which is what we call homomorphic. So this one is being done in time and frequency space. Same here. And then we look at the analysis. So the first thing to observe in this particular function is that it's an odd function if you reflect it about t equals 0. F of t goes to minus f of t. So because it's an odd function, we know that it can only be described by sines and a constant. All the cosine terms have to go to 0. So because it's an odd function, we know that all the a sub m's are equal to 0. Okay? Then if you want to think about the constant term a little bit, for the constant term, remember, if we look at the solution for the constant term, it would be this, where we're integrating over the period this function f of t. And if you look at f of t because of its symmetry about the halfway point in the over its period, it's half up here and half down here, and if you integrate the area of that, you'll end up with 0. So this integral is 0. Just like it is for sines and cosines. It's integrated over a single sine or a single cosine. So that means that that a sub 0 is 0. Okay? And then to find the b's, remember that the b term is these are coefficients of the sines. So to determine coefficients of the sines, I want to multiply both sides by the sine, and I want to multiply both sides by the sine of L omega t to project out the L coefficient of the sine series here. So if I multiply both sides by sine of L omega t and integrate over the period, then the left-hand side becomes this, and the right-hand side becomes the coefficient b sub L, and then remember, if we integrate the sine squared term over a full period, it will be 0 for everything except for m equal to L, and then you'll get a sine squared, and lambda t over 2 would be the integral for a sine squared over if you're integrating over a full period. So that's the right-hand side, projecting out the b sub L term. So we can solve for b sub L by now doing this integral. To do this integral, we have to substitute in what f of t happens to be. So I pull the 2 and the t over, so that's where these come from. And then I divide this integral up into two pieces because the function is clearly separable nicely that way. It's a constant positive 1 from 0 to pi over 2, t over 2. And it's constant negative 1 from t over 2 to t. So I simply put that in. So here, from 0 to t over 2, I have plus 1. From t over 2 to t, I have a minus 1. I pull the minus out. Okay? So then I do these integrals. Thank you.
of the sine is the minus L over W times the cosine. So the left-hand one, which was a positive sine L omega T, when I integrate it, I get a minus 1 over, I pull out the LW, cosine L omega T, I evaluate it between the limits of 0 and T over 2. And on the right-hand side, I do the same thing, then evaluate between the limits of T over 2 to T. I can pull the constants 1 over LW out. When I do, we can sort of look at that for a moment. This is 2 over T. This is L. Omega is 2 pi over the period, 2 pi over T. So that means if I put that in, I have 2 times 2 over the TL, 2 over the TL, and then I rewrite omega 2 pi over T. So this is just equal to 1 over L pi. So I pull the 1 over L pi down here. In the meantime, here, all of this stuff, when I evaluate it between T over 2 and 0, the cosine of T over 2, well, when I put in the T over 2 into this thing, the T's cancel, the 2's cancel, I end up with cosine of L pi. Then I subtract from that this thing evaluated at T equals 0. Cosine of 0 is 1. So I pulled the LW out, so this is just 1. Over here, I put in a T for the top, limit. And those cancel, and I end up with cosine of L times 2 pi, but that will always just be 1, because L is just an integer. So cosine is 0, 1, 2, 0, 2 pi, 4 pi, etc., etc., 3 pi, it's always... Right, because you have this 2 in here. You're getting integral multiples of 2 pi, so that will always be 1. The lower limit for the right-hand term here gives me the same thing as this first term. So I have a 1 and a 1, those add together to 2, and I have 2 times this minus cosine of L pi. I can pull the 2 through. So B sub L, when I evaluate these integrals, is just this. Okay? B sub L is a general constant. It is the coefficient of each of the signs in the infinite series that we use to describe this function. So B sub L is the L term in this infinite series. So if I really want to specify things, I have to allow L to change. 0, 1, 2, well, from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. So I'm going to have an infinite number of coefficients, and I have to calculate each of them separately to specify that series. Okay? So let's look at those for a moment. The good news is, because the L coefficient goes as 1 over L, I have 1 over L on here, so as L becomes large, the coefficients are going to become small. Okay? And if we just calculate the first two of them, first three of them. For B sub 1, I take this expression, I substitute in L equal 1, and I calculate it. So cosine of pi is minus 1. Minus 1 times minus times plus 1, so this is 2 times 2, so that's 4 over pi. B2 is 0, because I have cosine of 2 pi, which is 1, and 1 minus 1 is 0. B3 is not 0, so I have cosine of 3 pi, which is minus 1. So I get a 2 here, but now I have 4 over 3, because I'm evaluating L equal 3. So that's where I get 4 over 3 times, this should be 4 over 3 pi. You okay with that? You guys aren't asking enough questions. We're going to be done in 20 minutes because I have pre-prepared slides probably. But okay, we'll figure something to do. All right, so now let's look at it. I think it's going to start to get a little bit weirder. If we now plot the coefficients that are non-zero here, so if we now plot in omega space those coefficients that are non-zero, then in terms of omega, you can see that we have a non-zero term for omega equal to 1 omega, omega equal to 3 omega. You'll find that it's also, so you'll find that for all even omegas, it's 0, but for the odd omegas, you'll have something non-zero. They will drop in magnitude because you're incrementing this number at the bottom. And we've calculated only the first two, actually, here and here. And the third one happens to be 0.25, which I didn't calculate. But we can now make a plot of the relative contribution of each of these terms. So this is a measure of the size of the coefficient divided by the largest coefficient, which is the first one. So the first one is 1.27. So I plot 1.27 divided by 1.27, and I get a contribution at the fundamental frequency omega of 1. And just to remind you what the fundamental frequency omega is,
because we've done a lot of stuff since we saw it.
That's really coming from the actual function that you're trying to describe. This has a natural period. It has a period of t, which is 2 pi over omega. So that determines omega, and it's given to you right here. If I tell you what that period is, you have that fundamental frequency. Okay? So the largest term that's non-zero in the Fourier series that describes this thing is the one that has that fundamental frequency. Then the next one that's non-zero is the one that has that fundamental frequency times 3. So it has a wavelength that is 1/3 of the initial wavelength. And it comes in with a magnitude which is given here, which is about 0.42. 0.42 divided by 1.27 to get the relative contribution gives you 33% roughly. So this one comes in with a relative contribution of 30.23. The third non-zero term, which is the one where you have L equal to 5, comes in with a relative contribution of 0.25. And we can keep going. And in fact, I'm going to show you, well, we'll do a different example and we'll see sort of more of a full spectrum. But this is really, this picture is another way of looking at that function that's periodic in time. And we say that this is the description in frequency space. Because what you're doing is you're telling the relative contributions of how the different frequencies in the Fourier series contribute and describe that function in position space, I mean in time space. You okay with that?
What exactly is omega in our equation for B?
Omega is this is an equation for the coefficient that multiplies the first term in the sign piece of the Fourier analysis. So here you're calculating a coefficient. It doesn't have omega in it. Okay? But it multiplies the term that does have omega in it. And so it gives the relative contribution of that harmonic piece with that frequency to the total answer. So what it's telling you is that in terms of describing this function, you have one piece that comes in with a large contribution, that is, it has a large amplitude, because that's what's multiplying the sine thing, which has the fundamental frequency of the function. And then you have a piece which has an amplitude, which is one-third of that, comes in with three times the frequency, or one-third the wavelength, etc.
So B sub 4 is also 0?
B sub, yeah, all even ones are 0, which just is a product of
the equation that we have for B sub L.
Yeah, any time I have an even number here, the cosine of that will be 0. Sorry, the cosine's not 0, the cosine is 1. If this is an even number, the cosine is 1, and 1 minus 1 is 0, so the B sub L's are all 0. So those pieces of the sine all go to 0.
Okay, so that's the mathematical way of looking at it with this frequency space, but I think to make it make sense, what I'd like to do is to look at it graphically.
The first term has a coefficient, which is 1.27. It has a wavelength, which is the wavelength, the natural wavelength of the function. So here, in the blue lines, I have drawn the function f of t. Okay? And now, although my drawing is imperfect, I repeated that up above. Okay? I'm sorry, the blue lines here are the function. And then I've taken, in orange, 1.27 times the sine of omega t, where omega has the same period as my function. Same period, which means it starts here. It's a sine, so it starts at 0 here. And then it has the same period as the function. Okay? I have set function as amplitude 1. So the first term comes in with an amplitude of 1.27. So I draw it a little bit up above. It's not a perfect drawing, but I thought of taking the time to do it on Excel and think back on it. All right, so you can see that if I just take the first term of the series, remember the constant term is 0 as well. If I take the first term of the series, I get a sine function that is not horribly different from the function itself, but it's not perfect, right? It's a sine function instead of sort of a squared off thing. So then successive terms correct that a little bit. So the next term up is given in the pink. So that corresponds when L is equal to 3. So it corresponds to where the frequency is 3 times the fundamental frequency. So that every time I go one full wavelength here, I have three full wavelengths. So that means for the pink, it also has an amplitude. And I blew this. That's not 0.33. It should be 0.42. When I calculate B3, I get 0.42. When I look at the plot of the relative frequencies, I divide that by the 1.27, and that's what gave me the 0.33. But it's really the amplitude. That coefficient is 0.42. So that means when I look at that sine function, that as it adds in, remember these are harmonic functions, so they just add together. So that's all I'm doing, is I'm looking at an individual. So I look at the pink. I've drawn it a little bit small here because it should be a little closer to this line because it's 0.42. So the Nagin's amplitude is a little bit bigger. But
But basically, I know that it has to have three wavelengths and a single wavelength of the other, because its frequency is three times as high. So here's one, two, three, in the same wavelength as I have, in the same distance that I have there, for the same time. Okay? Then you can barely see it, but the third term, which I think also should be 0.25 times the 5 omega.
You probably have a really hard time seeing it. I sort of know not to use green, but I blew it. It's not 0.33, 0.25. It should be 0.25 times 1.27. So it also will be a little bit bigger than what I've shown on the drawing.
But that's given in green. Now I have a frequency that is 5 times the fundamental frequency, which means its amplitude is smaller, but I have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in the same way. And now what I'd like to do is to imagine adding these things all together. And when you do, you end up with a curve that looks something like that. So successively, you are getting something that looks a little bit more squared off at the top, a little sharper here. And as you add more and more and more terms, it asymptotically approaches this function. It's not, I mean, this isn't a perfect drawing. This kind of thing is pretty easy to do on a oscilloscope or with Excel. I maybe should have taken the time to do it, but you can sort of get the sense of what's going on. Any thoughts, questions? So a couple of the points that I wanted to make is that it is an infinite series, but I can make it as precise a description of this original function as I would like by just carrying more and more of those terms. The other point that I want to bring out is that what you'll notice just in a hand-waving sort of way is at the high omega, I'm sorry, at the fundamental, the lowest omega, the lowest frequency terms, I'm doing really just a broad brush description of the function. And as I add higher order terms, I'm beginning to describe finer features of that function. So you can imagine that that's what it takes, right? If I have features in this function that are very short in terms of time, then I need to describe that. The only way I can describe that is to have pieces in the description that have very short structure or very short periods of themselves. Okay? So as I want to describe smaller details in the function, I will bring in necessarily higher frequency components of the series. Their relative importance will be greater. I guess I should say it that way. Not just small features, but if you think about it, a sharp edge is a small feature. It's a very sharp feature in fact. So if you have something that has sharp edges, you will need some high frequency components to get that to work. And we do have that, a very sharp edge. Okay? Well, we substitute in. Once we have solved in the analysis, do a very broad brush again. I mean, it takes a while looking at this. Remember, we have the function. We can describe it as this constant plus all these various terms, an infinite series here, an infinite series here. These are general coefficients where each coefficient multiplies that harmonic function with that particular frequency. So each one of them carries a different constant in front of it that gives you the amplitude of that harmonic in the final sum. So when we solve for all of these, because it's an odd function, we know that all of these coefficients are zero, so there are no sines. I'm sorry, there are no cosines that come into play. Similarly, because of the way in which the function is even across, is symmetric within t, within one period, this term is zero. So we're left with only an infinite number of sine terms of successively higher frequencies with constants in front of them that correspond to the amplitude that each of those little pieces have. And those are generically called the B sub n vector. Okay. So then, to find the B sub m's, let me just choose one of them. Which one? We'll call it the L term. So L is now a general integer that corresponds to any particular one of these. Okay, so it's a generic thing at this point. And I then find the B sub m's by multiplying both sides by the sign L omega t. So I pick out a particular harmonic, a particular frequency within that series, and I take that sign and I multiply the whole thing by that. And when I do that, all of the terms except the one for m equal to L go to zero, which is why I project out only the B sub L here. Now I've just collapsed everything here except the ones where m is equal to L. So I have a very particular frequency term. On the left-hand side, I have this, where this is the original function. And when I do this integral, it allows me to solve for that particular coefficient. Okay? So then I solve for, in general, that particular coefficient by looking at that integral. And when I've done that, I then can increment that. I can say, okay, let's look at it for L equal 1, and that gives me the first term. Now we'll look at it for L equal 2, and that gives me the second term. Then we'll look at it for L equal 3, and gives me the third term. On up to an infinite number. Okay, so for each term in the series, you basically let increment L to be that number, and you evaluate it separately. So that's what we did here. So I take the B sub L, I evaluate this integral, and I get this expression. So all of those m infinite terms in that series, the coefficients that multiply each of these successively higher frequency harmonics is described here. And to get the first one, I set L equal 1. To get the second one, I set L equal 2, etc. So then I actually evaluate three of them. For L equal 1, I evaluate this expression where I set L equal to 1 and I get this 1.27. For L equal 2, I evaluate this expression, I find 0. So that term, which has a frequency which is twice that fundamental, happens to not contribute. B3 is non-zero, B4 is 0, B5 turns out to be this, which I didn't calculate up here. Okay? Yes?
You're saying the sine squared in the very beginning is almost 0, cosine squared?
The original function here is an odd function.
Sines are odd, cosines are even. So because it's an odd function, I cannot have a cosine contribute to it. So therefore, when I look at this, I know that all the A sub m's are zero by inspection because of the odd even aspect. Okay?
No, that's fine. If I have some function and I have that f of x is equal to f of minus x, this would be even.
if f of x is equal to minus f of x, then it would be odd. So, yes, thank you. Minus f of minus x. So, practically speaking, for cosine, what it means is if you put a mirror here at x equals 0, you can fold it, and it's mirror symmetric. For the sine, which would mean it's even, because the cosine of minus x is equal to cosine of x, so that's an even function. If you look at sine functions, the cosine of minus x, the sine of minus x is minus the sine of x. And that's an odd function. So again, in your mind, if you put a mirror at x equals 0 and you fold it over, you know, and you look at the mirror, do you have to flip it or not? If you have to flip it, it's an odd function. Sure. Okay. So we increment the L's and we calculate the size of the coefficient on each of those harmonic terms. And so they give you the degree to which each of those terms contributes in terms of its amplitude to that final sum of the various harmonic functions. Okay? And then if you want to look at that, those contributions in frequency space, you can take those relative amplitudes and plot them on a line of just frequency, and you end up with particular frequencies that are non-zero, and they contribute. And we actually think of this as another way of describing the same function, this being described in frequency space instead of time space. Okay. If you've never seen this before, I hope some of these words are now starting to sink in. You've heard of frequency analyzers and spectrum analyzers. Right? Anything you're using in optics, you can take a pulse in time and analyze it in terms of the contributing frequencies. So that's sort of where we're headed. So we're taking this function and we're describing it in terms of a sum with relative contributing amplitudes of these higher frequency components that when you begin to add them together, in this case we're only doing the first three, you can see that it's a little bit of a close approximation, and as I add more terms in, it gets closer and closer. Okay? I'm going to draw this red line. The stuff that we've done with Fourier analysis prior to this is something that we're going to practice that I would expect you to be able to do on the test. Okay? First, I give you a particular function. You tell me the coefficients. Maybe you can even approximate a drawing of it or something like that. Okay? Look at what are the size of the frequency. Yeah.
So way at the beginning of this, you said that in Fourier analysis, you add up the amplitude, frequency, phase. Is there ever actually a difference in phase between the components that are being added up? It seems like only sines and only cosines.
Certainly what we did was just sines and cosines, but you know, the truth is, probably I can put in the phase by throwing in some sine of that same frequency with a different amplitude. I'd have to think a moment about that, but I don't think I ever have to put in a phase actually, because it just means that I have some of the other harmonic or some of the other orthogonal harmonics fusing in, I think. Okay, so now what I want to do is to stretch this a bit further and try to give you some intuition about some things that we're going to see in quantum mechanics, and we'll also feed into kind of lots of stuff you see in optics and stuff. But we're now going to start to get on with this class, which is very thin ice, but it's stuff you're going to see a lot, and you will get very good at, and you'll see it in other classes a lot. And some of these classes, you're going to get way good at this. But for right now, what I want to do is give you a feeling for it. But from now until I finish this particular topic, it's not something where I'm expecting you to do it in class. But I want to give you a feeling for why we're bothering with all this. And it is incredibly important, actually, so I'll try to convey that before we're done. Let me do sort of the same thing that we just did, but now let's use a different function. And the function that I want to choose this time would be a classic square wave. Square wave being, you basically have this, okay, but repeat it with a wavelength lambda. And I'm going to describe the width of the squares, and it's, the way I've drawn it here, it's an even function. And I'm going to say that the width of this square is characterized by lambda divided by a. So as a is an integer, as a becomes larger, this square wave becomes narrower. And we're not doing it because I don't want to drag you through it. But when you do Fourier analysis of this function, what you find is this solution. So in this case, the zeroth term isn't zero. It turns out to be 2 over a. And it's an even function. So all the signs go to zero, so the divisive ends all end up being zero, because sine is an odd function. So you say, good. When you look up here, you say, I'm glad to see there's a cosine. So remember, I have an infinite series of cosines of successively higher spatial frequency. K is basically my spatial frequency, it's 2 pi over the lambda. Okay? Think of this as cosine terms with successively smaller wavelengths. Each of these terms, the nth term, is multiplied by an a sub m, which is, when you solve for it in this problem, this is the answer you get for each of the a m terms. So for a 1, I put n equal 1, and I solve for that. For a 2, I put n equal 2, I solve for it. For a 3, I put in n equal 3, and I solve for it. Okay? So let's look at this for a moment, because it's, if I take this and I sort of clean it up a tiny bit, this 4 over a and this m2 pi over a, when you collapse it together, you get this 2 over m pi times the sine. So in terms of m, here is the coefficient that multiplies that nth harmonic term in this description. Note, first of all, the sine, remember, is something that's limited between plus or minus 1. Okay? So the overall amplitude is driven a bit by this 1 over m. So what it's telling you is that the envelope of the contribution of each of these successively higher frequency components, or higher, yeah, spatial frequency components, is going to have to drop off as 1 over m. So the really high ones are going to have to contribute less than the long wavelength pieces. Okay? And then the other thing to realize is that I have something here which is a sine. And all I'm really doing when I vary m, once a is determined, a is just how big this thing is I'm varying the frequency or the wavelength at which the sine contributes. So this piece is going to be sinusoidal in terms of, if I look at sort of how these things contribute as a function of m, I'm going to have a piece that is sinusoidal in him, and a piece that falls off is 1 over him, sort of. I know many of you may have this textbook, but if you look at Hecht's optics text, and you look at his initial description of anharmonic functions, you'll find this stuff. Because I like this treatment. And in fact, that is the reference I would give you for this Fourier analysis and the stuff that we're doing today with Dean Hecht. But that chapter contains stuff that's beyond a little bit what I'm really expecting you to do, but it is the place to go to see this. At any rate, he takes this particular function and plays with it. And I think it's very instructive to see what happens with it as we look at it. So here it is, and we have a generic A, and this is the generic solution that we get from Fourier's analysis. Okay? Hecht now takes that and he plots. He sets A equal to 4. So we have lambda over 4 being the width of the box. Okay? So here's lambda, and this is lambda over 4. With having specified A, he then substitutes in different m's and looks at the amplitude of, he calculates each of the A sub m's, right? So he looks at the amplitude multiplying the harmonic function with that m. He has the constant term, which is the initial term that we saw, which I forget what it was now, something over A. It's 2 over A, so 2 over 4 is going to be 1/2. So when you calculate what A0 is, you get 1/2, and that's not 1/2. Maybe he's normalizing them. Yeah, he may be normalizing them. At any rate, you want to look at the spatial frequency spectrum. So you want to look at it in K space, not X space. So what he plots here is the relative contribution of each of the various higher harmonic pieces. And notice some of them are negative. Okay? So you can subtract out some of these terms too to get the shape right. So if you do it, this goes on and on and on, but if you calculate for each m the amplitude that multiplies that particular harmonic, here are the relative amplitudes. Some are 0, some are big and positive, but as you go out in m, you get smaller and smaller and smaller. And this whole thing has this 1 over r drop that we saw, and it has this sinusoidal wiggle in MK space. I said sinusoidal. What's the first time?
That may be because your A0 is non-zero.
And we have this piece in there which has to add together. So the first one of these that's non-zero is the A1. And if you just take the sign itself, in fact, this will be coming down. But then you have that A0 term going in, and that's in, I think. But basically, the idea is that you now see this discrete spectra of frequencies shown by these amplitudes. This would be what this curve looks like if you put it in frequency space, spatial frequency space. Okay? You're spectrum analyzing that square wave. That means I take this curve, the question is how, what do you mean by the frequency scale? I take this curve, I find the Fourier equivalent thing, and I look at those frequencies that contribute to the Fourier description of it, and I make a plot of those frequencies. And so that would be the picture of this spatial curve in frequency space. And if you know one, you know the other. You can move back and forth. So it is just a different description of the same thing. You having fun yet? Yes.
So what this is looking like, if you have that lambda over A is the same, no matter what the space between the sort of the negative pulses are here, it always just works off the same damn sine function, it's just sampled in different places.
Yeah, well, so let me now move there. Okay, so let us now set A equal to 8 instead of 4. Then what happens is you have a smaller thing spatially. So you now have to have the higher frequency components have to contribute relatively more to describe the smaller spatial thing. So what you find when you do that is that these terms get compressed in a little bit. So here's the first, second, third. And so you sort of have the same envelope, but now the frequencies sort of get squeezed in. Or if you want to keep the exact MK axis here, you can sort of imagine that this envelope spreads out so that you have the higher frequency components contributing more. Okay? Because you have a smaller feature. If I let lambda get very big, well, no, now if I do lambda over 16, you get sort of the same behavior, okay? So in that sense, you can think of the frequency spectrum within the envelope of these amplitudes becomes much denser, and the higher frequencies are more important as you begin to have features that are very fine. Well, so that's basically what I just said. So I can make this square wave go very narrow. But when I do, you can think of these frequencies becoming very dense in there, or you can think of this envelope basically becoming wide. That is, the envelope of important frequencies has to encompass higher and higher frequencies. Okay. So that's what I ran out of steam last night in making these. So there's a general point there. As the features become small that you have to describe, you have higher frequency components that are very important. Or in general, as the wavelength becomes really long, so that the relative size of this becomes important, when you describe it in frequency space, basically more and more frequencies become important. So there's sort of this inverse relationship between the spatial frequency and the spatial size. Size small, the spatial frequency that you have to use to describe it gets very big. If I go to big size, the spatial frequency that I need to describe it gets very small. Okay, yes?
If you're
you're only going to have to a certain number of neurons, so I think that would be an idea.
You probably have a functional form of what's going on with amplitude, so each one that you add has only a certain degree of contribution, so you can probably mathematically limit how big they can be and get an error. I don't know. And we can probably do a calculation for a very particular example. If you calculate this out only to so many terms, how much are you off by in terms of the error underneath the square root? We could do that as a problem and calculate that. But there you know what the answer is. So, I mean, I guess you do know, right? You already know what function is you're trying to do, so you can compare that with what you get and then ask how big is, how far you're off. So. All right, so in a sense, if you think of that envelope as being somewhat fixed, you can sort of also think of compressing the k-space, the frequency space, if you want. So these frequencies become denser, if you want to think of it that way. At any rate, all of that is to make the following sort of plausible for you. This is called Fourier series. So if you can imagine what happens when we started the Fourier series, we said we can describe any function that has spatial period lambda or temporal period t, right? And so we are only analyzing periodic functions. But now we've begun to look at the behavior that happens when you have this wavelength change. So, of course, if you want a pulse rather than a periodic thing, just let that wavelength go to infinity. And there's your pulse, right? So what we'd like to do is to describe a pulse. But when you do that, you're effectively making that frequency spectrum infinitesimally tight. Right? I mean, you're expanding that frequency thing. You now have to worry about all frequencies, and you can sort of think of them as adding together in a continuous way. So, in the limit where lambda goes to infinity, where you might be able to describe something like a completely anharmonic function, a pulse or whatever, then you can go to this limit. So now we sort of go to the limit where we have continuous functions, these integrals that you can do. And now the A sub k's and the B sub k's are given by the following. I don't expect you to feel warm and fuzzy about that. Good. If you do, you have more mathematical insight than I do. I'm pulling this a bit out of the hat, but I hope that at least the this idea of, as lambda goes to infinity, that you can sort of take these sums and they become these functions. No, they're not. Thanks. One is a sign. That's a sign, so that should be a sign. There were other questions. Yes. You have to have, well, infinitely long is a little bit hard. I mean, the tangent is maybe zero. But as you get more features, you know, infinite number of shorter wavelength pieces, I guess, is the way to go. I mean, I'm not proving this to you. So you'll see that elsewhere other times. Is there another question? All right, so these things, these A sub k's and B sub k's, are called the cosine and sine transforms of f of x. So these are now smooth functions in frequency. These are smooth functions in frequency that depend on this function, f of x, which can be plugged in here to reproduce what f of x is. So these are functions that are basically frequency descriptions of the spatial. And they're called, these are called the sine and cosine transforms. And honestly, you don't usually see them that way. You've seen this probably. There's an identity that e to the I theta is equal to cosine theta plus I sine theta, where I is now a complex number. So this is an identity, okay? You're probably beginning to see it a lot, but if you were like me, it makes no sense. Okay, so I'm going to tell you trick number 364, you plot your little physics decoder ring, and just remember that you're not supposed to tell people this, because that's what makes this shit hard and keeps you in jobs. Okay? Here's the trick. Remember, if I have this complex thing and I look at just the real part of this, what is it? It's cosine of theta. That's not hard. So that means that A sub k equal to the integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x cosine kx dx, which doesn't look too bad, right? A little cosine, people have seen that before. You can now completely disguise that by saying that this is times the real part of e to the I kx dx, which happily looks a lot tougher, a little bit opaque. And to make it worse and ultimately confusing and an absolute barrier even for majors until they actually get told the trick or figure it out on their own, you now drop this. It's just understood, he said. Okay? So, this is normally written And it's the transform, the frequency transform, the Fourier transform of f of x. So we have a description in frequency space and a description in spatial space, or a description in time, description in temporal frequency. Okay? And they are equivalent, and you can move back and forth. Yes? You know, it's sort of weird, and I won't say that I'm real happy with it, and I don't have to do it every day, so I...
But basically, you can do a lot of your manipulations just using this complex stuff and just take the real part out.
Yeah. Oh, so basically, you're still saying the real part of what it is.
Yeah. Just have to know by context. I have to do my calculations. So, for example, when I have, when I square two waves that are described, and what we're going to find is we also can describe waves in terms of this complex notation. Why? How do we describe waves? Sines or cosines. Anything I have is sines or cosines, I can put into this complex notation. There might be some deep reason to do it, but I think you do it just because once you get used to it, these complex notations are a lot easier to visualize and use in calculations and things. But if, for example, you're going to square two waves and they're in complex notation, you have to square it right, which means you have to multiply the complex conjugate by putting the minus sign from the one times the... And it's really easy to square exponentials, which is, I think, why we do this. Certainly the reason I'm pulling it out in part was to let you know what these transforms are so that you've seen them. We're not going to do anything with transforms. All we're going to do is some Fourier analysis. That said, we're going to use waves described in the e to the ikx minus omega t. And the reason we're going to do that is because for many of the problems that we will have, we will actually have wave pulses, and for wave pulses, it's easier to describe them in terms of complex notation. And do calculations. What you're going to find is in some cases, in quantum mechanics, we're going to want to describe the wave in terms of sines and cosines, because it's a lot easier to calculate based on the boundary conditions, and in other cases, we'll describe them as a complex notation. So I think it's just really for calculational convenience. That said, you may run into some theorist in the Institute of Optics over here who has some deep religious reason why this is a great thing that I never ran into. So.
Yeah, if you were to look, just asking, if you were to look at this as domain, would you say f of x is kind of like the
Well, f of x in this case is that. It's a square, you can, well, f of x is whatever you've got, which is in my mind. So it could be a square wave pulse, so it could just be a pulse. Okay? It's whatever the function is. And all I'm saying is whatever that function is, I can calculate its description in frequency space by calculating a's and b's. This would just be just the a, but we'll get to the ikx. All right. Now you might ask, that's really cool, Professor Manley, but why do I care? Okay, so why you care, you may care for many reasons, but among the reasons, and in particular in this class, the reason I want you to care is that this inverse relationship that you get in frequency space and spatial or time space turns out to be, it's fundamentally important. It is a very basic fundamental characteristic of waves. I haven't pulled any quantum mechanics out here. I haven't done anything fancy. Right? This is all classic waves. Okay? But now it turns out that, as we'll get to it, in quantum mechanics, things really get going when a guy named de Broglie, and we'll come back to this, claimed that particles, which we've always thought of as spatially,
have a discrete position in space, that particles have wave-like characteristics. And in his PhD thesis, which he won a Nobel Prize for, top that, he said that a particle has a wavelength that is equal to some constant, which Planck's constant, and we'll come back to that, over the particle's momentum. Or, he said that the particle goes as 1 over lambda, which really goes as k. I mean, the momentum goes roughly as k, the k we've been using, the spatial frequency. Okay? And what we have just found, if we now describe a particle as a wave, and you think of it as having finite spatial extent, we now have this weird inverse relationship between its finite extent and its description in K space, spatial frequency space, which de Broglie tells us is momentum space. If I know where it is, I don't know its momentum in frequency space. If I know its momentum very well, I don't know where this particle is because it's very broad pulse. Right? That's the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. And it leads to an infinite number of really weird things. Okay? But it's really just waves. The minute you say particles are waves, you have this inverse, the uncertainty principle kicks in. Yeah?
What's the name after Isaac?
He's the one who said, this is the way it is.
I mean, this dude comes up with this idea, and it was, I mean, I'll try to motivate it for you, but it's a little bit pulled out of thin air, okay? And this whole idea of waves and particles is really weird, and one of the reasons that he said this is because, as we're about to do, we're about to go into electromagnetic waves, and they are totally waves, okay? Light is totally a wave, and then all of a sudden, people began to realize there are these few little things that you can't explain unless you think of light as particles, but we know it's a wave, so that makes no sense. So people were sort of trying to come to grips with that, and this guy came along and said, well, if waves can be particles, maybe particles can be waves. And then the minute you say that, and you start doing the wave analysis of it, then you get all these weird things happening. So Heisenberg did that. So I don't know. Okay, I'm running late, so we gotta go.